Welcome to the Best Science Medicine Podcast, BS without the BS.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the 490th episode of the Best Science Medicine Podcast. My name is James McCormack, and I'm a professor with the Faculty of Pharmaceutical Sciences at the University of British Columbia.
I'm Mike Allen. I'm a family doctor and the director of practice support at the College of Family Physicians of Canada. I'm also an adjunct professor at the University of Alberta. Now, James, there's controversy afoot in the field of COVID, and we needed someone smart to guide us through this, someone who has some experience in the field and perhaps some of the greatest brains. So we looked all over and hiding in a spider hole in Peace River were Mike and Tony.
Absolutely, yeah. And it's so controversial, we felt we needed two additional people. We don't do that
very
often.
Yeah, we need two people to sort this out. Yes. We're going to take the pro and they're going to take the con.
Yeah, no. So Mike Colmer, introduce yourself.
Hi, everyone. Mike Colmer, a family physician out of Peace River and academic at the University of Alberta. And I have a good friend, Tony Nikinchuk. Tony.
Yeah, Tony Nikinchuk. I am also based out of Peace River, and I work for Alberta Health Services, Provincial Pharmacy Services in the Drug Utilization and Stewardship Portfolio.
And just because we have literally nothing better to do, we decided we thought we would tackle ivermectin. And that's where we're going with this one. And it's based on a tools of practice that we published literally just a day ago. And the authors of this were Mike and Tony. And why don't you guys just take it away?
Sure. So I think what we'll do is I'll kind of discuss the evidence, and then Mike is going to talk about some context and some background with this. So ivermectin is an antiparasitic drug that is used for real conditions in humans, and it has evidence for it in those conditions, but it gained a lot of interest in being used for COVID, and there's been some research and lots of sort of popular media reporting around this, and so we figured it was time to try and look into, you know, where the best research is and summarize it for people out there. There's a lot of information out there about ivermectin. Not all of it is equally quality, so to speak. So we tried to focus on quality randomized controlled trials and systematic reviews where they existed, and just try to focus on the published research if possible. Not as much the preprints if we could. So the two best ones we found were Vallejos and Lopez Medina, which were the two RCTs that we focused on in the tool. And they were two of the larger RCTs that were done in this space, and two of the higher quality ones as well. The other thing I'll mention is there's kind of a significant divider in the COVID literature between inpatients and outpatients, right? So a lot of research has been done only on inpatients. And, you know, with some therapies, we find benefit in inpatients, none in outpatients, or vice versa. So it's important to delineate what patient group the treatments are being studied in. And so most of the discussion around ivermectin has focused on outpatient therapy, almost kind of like prophylaxis. So giving to patients with mild or moderate COVID, who are not hospitalized, they're still at home, and seeing if we can prevent progression to more severe disease. So it was sort of from that lens that we focused on this. And so the first one was a RCT with 400 patients with mild COVID at home. There was a small chunk of them that were hospitalized without oxygen support, but most were at home. And they were randomized to ivermectin or placebo. And their main outcome was time to symptom resolution, and there was no statistically significant difference between the two groups. And then there was another larger trial of 501 outpatients. They were all outpatients, and they were randomized to ivermectin or placebo for 2 days. And in this one, they were looking at COVID-related hospitalizations. And again, there was no statistically significant difference between the two. There is also a high-quality Cochrane collaboration does a high-quality living meta-analysis. It's at covid-nma.com. And they are essentially constantly updating the research coming in and updating forest plots with all of the outcomes that are reported in this research. And they're importantly going through and, you know, providing quality filters to the trials that they include and stuff. So we also looked at that, and their forest plot for all-cause mortality at day 28 had four trials in it that they felt met the quality criteria, and they again found no statistically significant impact of ivermectin on all-cause mortality. And in fact, for all of the clinical outcomes that they looked at, including things like resolution of symptoms, clinical improvement, that sort of stuff, they found no statistically significant impact of ivermectin compared to placebo or standard care.
And I think, you know, I think it's great that such a thing as a, what they call a living meta-analysis, because it allows us to sort of follow along, because things can change over time. And go ahead.
Yeah, it's especially tough with COVID, right? Because the data is coming out so fast and frequently. And so, you know, there was one meta-analysis that was published a while ago by Bryant et al., and a big trial came out afterwards that isn't included in that meta-analysis that, you know, added a lot to the picture. Mm-hmm. And so with published meta-analysis, practically by the time it's published, it's already out of date, right?
Right, yeah.
And so, you know, having a group like Cochrane running a living meta-analysis is really valuable, I think, because you can kind of constantly go back and see, hey, has anything changed in this space? And see where the evidence sits now.
Yeah, and I know the a couple of the studies in the tool we give the numbers of what they found, and so, you know, in the second one that you talked about, you know, when they look at COVID-19 related hospitalizations, it was for ivermectin, it was 5.6 versus 8.4% in placebo. So now that was not statistically different, but I would suggest that if in fact we studied thousands of people and found that difference, that might be a clinically important difference, but we can't say that it did anything. And especially if, when you say you look at the high quality living meta-analysis, they're not showing any statistically significant impact on any of the any clinical outcomes.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's the importance of trying to draw people to these good resources too, because I didn't know it existed until I was about halfway through up to now, right? So it's a really good place to see, because of course, yeah, you can have a finding like this, and if it was held through multiple studies and you meta-analyze them, yeah, that would probably be a statistically significant finding. But it's also potentially that it was just a chance difference with exactly. This one trial, and yeah. When you include them all together, you wouldn't find anything.
Yeah, so that's sort of for the outpatient population, but there have been other ones that sort of combine outpatients and inpatients.
Yeah. So the Bryant meta-analysis, for example, it's referenced a lot in when people are trying to talk about the effectiveness of ivermectin. And one of the issues with it is that the trials, some were outpatients, some were inpatients. And then also they had different comparators as well. It wasn't all ivermectin versus placebo or standard of care. Importantly, in the meta-analysis, they actually write ivermectin versus no ivermectin. That's what they call the comparison for their meta-analysis. And so there are trials where it's, you know, ivermectin versus doxycycline or ivermectin versus hydroxychloroquine or other comparators like that. And so they took all those. Some were outpatient, some were inpatient, some were placebo, some were not, you know, and kind of lumped them all together and came up with a result that they say is compelling and statistically significant. Cochrane later published a meta-analysis that kind of came to different conclusions, and I believe there was an editorial from Cochrane calling into question the methodology of the Bryant meta-analysis too.
Right.
A couple other things with the Bryant and the evolution. Bryant came first. Cochrane published, like you talked about, Cochrane, the published Cochrane came second, but that was also part of the living network meta-analysis. So in the published Cochrane that was earlier, I think in the spring, it only had one of the two high-quality RCTs. So the living meta-analysis now includes the second RCT, the Lopez trial, and again, says the same thing. Mm-hmm. Bryant is held into question about, again, Tony said, comparing to ineffective treatments, right? having treatments that unbalanced. So correct me if I'm wrong, Tony, a couple of the Bryant papers also had like ivermectin plus corticosteroids for inpatients. Was that correct, Tony?
Yeah, and there were like one of the studies, there were like 7 arms or something, and like I think there were like 12 people in each arm or something, and you know, and they had different ivermectin protocols. Like one was 12 mgs for one day, one was 3 mgs for 5 days, one was 6 mgs for 7 days, you know, and there was all these different ones, but they just took the results and just kind of lumped them all together. And some even had, like I was looking at one and it was ivermectin versus placebo, ivermectin versus hydroxychloroquine, ivermectin plus hydroxychloroquine versus placebo. And it was just a schmoz, basically.
Which is actually a scientific term.
It is, yes.
Yeah, yeah. But and that's the tricky part about, especially around COVID and things like ivermectin, is that you could probably search and find one of these relatively poorly designed one trials and show there you go, it shows that it does this. But that's not kind of how science works. Is what you want to do is take the best design trials, use that information, and that's what you guys tried to do with this tools for practice. And there certainly is nothing compelling, if you would, in regards to what you're finding. If you and it's, you know, you can only a study of ivermectin versus hydroxychloroquine doesn't give you any useful data at all.
No,
comparing to ineffective treatments early in COVID, I guess if you're an optimist, you say, you know what, maybe because we're not sure. Mm-hmm. But again, if you're a pessimist, you wonder if they're doing it for whatever reasons. And I think the science should be placebo. The other thing is the science for ivermectin, really, we really should concentrate on outpatients. Inpatients have data, mm-hmm. whether it be corticosteroids, mm-hmm. Whether it be, Tony, help me with the names.
Tocilizumab.
Yeah, you bet. So there's a few other. So where there's really where there's a void is what do you do for the outpatients?
Mm-hmm.
I think that's where this is gaining the momentum. So again, what Tony said, we concentrated on the outpatients, and we also concentrated not on viral loads, not on petri dish stuff, but clinical outcomes. And I think that's really important for the listeners to understand, mm-hmm. is that we took the highest quality RCTs that looked at patient-oriented outcomes. Yeah. While some medications may show surrogate marker differences, we really think it's important to look at clinical outcomes. And like Tony said, in the living meta-analysis, whether it be all-cause mortality, hospitalization, death, any way you kind of clinical improvement, day 28, any way you slice it, there really isn't anything there. We don't care what the evidence shows. We just want you to show the evidence.
Yeah,
we'll show it to you.
I was going to say I didn't want to speak for everybody on the podcast, but I would literally love it if ivermectin worked.
I'd be happy.
I'd be happy with it.
I think I'd be happy if it did. I think there's some issues, and I try. You know, you try and figure out where does the media, where does this belief in ivermectin come from? Tony alluded to some of this in the introduction. A lot of this stuff is a lot of the data is published not in peer reviewed journals, but in preprints. Lots of small numbers. If you look at clinicaltrials.gov, there's 75 trials on ivermectin. Just by that alone, you're going to find a few due to chance.
Mm-hmm.
Many of them are low quality, very small numbers, high risk of bias, and many just report on surrogate markers. And it's very compelling that if it's an antiparasitic and changes replication of the whatever, it's very compelling that must work. You know, if it shows it in the petri dish, it's got to be right in the humans. We're just not either testing the right human. I don't know.
Yeah, and you were bringing up, because you said there was this one meta-analysis which was reported, but there's some questions around it along with a study that reported mortality benefit. But there's questions around both of those, right?
Yeah, and that's often cited, and that also shows mortality benefit and says the likelihood of this being wrong is 1 in 1 trillion. Mm-hmm. I've never seen that outside of astrophysicists and deciding whether there's a new planet or not.
Yeah.
Included cohort studies and conclusions about the study quality. The study within there that it was kind of referenced the largest mortality effect, which is available in preprint, was actually retracted from the preprint when a student in UK somewhere kind of said, this is so positive. When we find differentiating, we say outliers in evidence. If you look at a forest plot, it all looks similar, and one's outlier, you kind of go, I wonder what's different. And this student kind of looked and said, wait a minute. I don't know how he got the data, but found that there was duplicate patients who were enrolled, but they were dead. And so this was actually retracted from the preprint in investigating, which is incredible. And this meta-analysis, A, included that, and it seems like it has the same author that's either running it or commenting it, because it says a Twitter feed by that person. So again, it's a bit odd, but I think we can explain some of this is that it's there's a whole undercurrent of this preprint information and the thoughts that journals are conspiracy, you know, have conspiracy against publicizing, you know, publishing these great studies, but they're not great studies. So
yeah, and I think that is part of the problem is that, you know, if you use sort of a scientific process to look at all of this information, we do this all the time for everything. It's not just that we're picking on COVID or even ivermectin or whatever, but it's a systematic approach to look at it. And when, like you say, if a study is being retracted, it doesn't matter what it is. People don't include it in anything. No. But the problem is once it's out there, and then there's a meta-analysis that's out there. And you're right, the sort of the people who say, well, clearly it must work is because, you know, these are all being hidden purposely. And, you know, why would you not report this meta-analysis? And it's because there's a systematic approach. And I know, Mike, you, in the context, you guys, there's lots of COVID preprints, but there's all sorts of problems with those as well.
Yeah, so Tony and I, we had nothing better to do with it. Tony actually pulled how many COVID preprints there were. And there's over 14,000. And we actually found, kind of worked through this and tried to calculate, well, how many of these are actually published? Mm-hmm. We did a kind of a small sample size, and we found that about 30% are published in peer-reviewed journals about a year later. So Tony ran some numbers on that. So, you know, okay, so 30%. I struggle with the shiny and the bright and the I think that there's a common theme, a press release, and I'll use a culture scene when the press, and this was a study that was ran for by the Montreal Heart Institute. So when it came out in January, it said culture scene is major scientific breakthrough to treat COVID-19. And that was in January, and that was the Cole Corona trial. The preprint said, yeah, again, colchicine reduces the composite rate of death or hospitalization. When you actually get to the published manuscript in May and nothing changed, the numbers were the same. The conclusion, and I think we live in the 30-second soundbite, and we just read, most of the lay people read conclusions. The conclusion, when it was published formally in Lancet, showed colchicine on COVID-19 clinical events was not statistically significant. Same numbers, completely different conclusion. Mm-hmm. When you pull the paper, you go, geez, there's a lot of issues with this paper. Multiple interim analysis with minimal changing of the p-value from 0.05 to 0.049. Mm-hmm. And the knowledge ratios, not relative risk. Just all these things that if I did, I think I'd be in trouble if I tried to do this. So again, I think we're just trying to shine a light on, we see press releases, we see preprints, and then we see the real data, and we have the ability to pull the stuff and actually look at it a little closer. And unfortunately, many of the times it's never as efficacious as these earlier prints. And I think it's just while we're looking for something for outpatients for COVID, not inpatients, I can see why people are trying to find it. But I also think we need to be cautious. You know, we used to say never be the first person to prescribe the new med or the last on the old. I think I would say now never be the first for the new. And I'm okay with the old. Mm-hmm. But that's just my clinical practice, for sure. I'm happy that it looks like there might be we just saw a few two RCTs that came out on inhaled budesonide.
Yeah,
and that may make a difference for outpatients as far as hospitalizations, emergency visits, that kind of stuff. And so maybe there's something there. But so we tried to shine the light on ivermectin, the highest quality literature. This is a question that has to be answered by RCTs, not by not by cohorts. So high quality RCTs, looking at patient-oriented outcomes. We'd love to show you there was a difference. There is no difference on the two largest, and also in the systematic review. And we're just trying to shine the light on some of the issues with preprints. We have to be careful.
Yeah. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, sometimes it distracts from just the good science. Good science has to prevail. In COVID, unfortunately, is almost we're seeing acceleration of either bad science or promotion of stuff that is not really clinically effective, and I think it's to the detriment of individuals.
And like even that example of the culture scene one, yeah, I looked at it as well, and the numbers didn't change. It was the interpretation, and that's why we, you know, probably for 490 podcasts, we've said, don't read the conclusion, because that is, those are written by humans. What, go look at the numbers and see what they say, and then make a decision. And it's never black and white anyway from a single study. You know, it's just something that, but you're right. It was had to do with whether it was statistically significant or not. And it's not black and white. Neither the preprint or the publication are for sure true that it works or it didn't work. And that's the tricky part. But another one of the concerns, though, with all of this is, you know, ivermectin is not without problems, right?
Yeah, for sure. So if you read a CDC report, poison control centers are having more calls for ivermectin toxicity. Symptoms can be all over the place. From it seems like mild GI-related nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, belly pain, and to bad stuff like decreased level of consciousness and seizures. And I think we have to recognize that there are potential harms with these medications. And if a little bit doesn't work, more is not better. And so I think we just have to recognize that, unfortunately, people are taking it. And I would just say, for those that do wish to take it, I would just pay attention to these potentially toxic symptoms.
Yeah. Mike Allen, any comments?
Two comments. When this was proposed, it was brought to me by Adrian, and she said it was just about ready. And I said, really? I didn't think there was anything on ivermectin, because like all of us, I kind of try and keep up a bit with the literature. Mm-hmm. She said, no, there's not. And then I was like, well, why are we doing this? And she explained this controversy, because I'm the one that truly lives in a spider hole. I don't know what's going on. I live in my little island off another island and don't pay attention. So I didn't even know about this controversy. Mm-hmm. But one of the things that we're missing here that I think is relevant to the conversation is part of the enthusiasm for ivermectin is because it's the rallying cry for a movement against vaccines. So you don't need vaccines because we have this wonderful alternative. And I think that for many people, that gives the escape valve for the issue of avoiding the vaccine, because they have a possible mechanism to intervention to rely on in place. And so I think some of what we're seeing is an enthusiasm to embrace an alternative that sounds very sciencey, which is a big part of this kind of thinking. You need something that sounds sciencey. And then this idea that you're creating metagraphs on a website that can somehow, that really, really can be convincing from a science perspective, it adds to the power of a narrative. And so there's a lot of things here that allow people to quickly come to the conclusion, because it favors a belief system for them.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
That this information is being withheld from them, that there's a secret out there that could cure it all for this man-made disease, you know, et cetera. And so there's a lot of, there's an enthusiasm to find something that science is hiding from us. And now, as Mike and Tony have just done, denied the science.
And like I tried to point out, you know, if we were, if we owned a company that makes vaccines, if we had money in an alternative group that was looking at other things, you know, maybe we shouldn't be trusted, but we don't care. I truly mean it. I wish ivermectin worked. Otherwise, all of these people who are getting all these toxicities, what a waste of time, energy, and potential harm. And like you said, Mike, it's, you know, ivermectin is not the only argument for why people go against the vaccines, but it is one of them, one of the many that there are.
But it's a strong one, James, to rally.
Yeah.
Because it's a solution to the problem. It's not just they're risky, they're not studied, they're everything. And we've joked before about how they're better studied than acetaminophen.
Mm-hmm.
But this is the solution to, well, what else are we going to do? Ivermectin, as Mike pointed out, there's only one in a trillion chance that it's wrong, that it doesn't work. So if I can believe that, then I'm off to the races, and I finally feel relieved from any pressure that I might have related to taking a vaccine.
Right. Yeah, I know, for sure. So
there's a really thoughtful undercurrent here of how these things bubble up into the media.
Yeah, no, for sure. And so what we try to do, this is the best available evidence we have. Mike Colbert or Tony, anything else you want to add?
Maybe Tony, just the manufacturer's statement. Oh, sure. And then maybe the response from the flaky group in the, I think, U.S. and their response.
Basically, what happened was Merck, the maker of ivermectin in at least Canada and the U.S., they came out with what is pretty rare, a public statement asking people essentially to not use their drug for COVID, which you don't really see that often. They might not always come up.
I think never might be a...
Yeah, exactly. You're not always going to see them come out and explicitly promote it, but if anything, they usually just sit back and let it happen. But this time they said, no, please don't use our product for COVID-19. We have no evidence that it worked. And this group in the U.S. who has this, I think it's called the iMask Plus protocol. It's quite something. FLCCC group. They actually then came out and said that, no, Merck is wrong. They have clearly misunderstood the evidence. So, which was quite the mental twisties to see in out there. So yeah, never. I don't think I've seen that before in my many years as a pharmacist. A manufacturer actually discouraging use of its product.
No, I'm the same.
And nor somebody disagreeing with the manufacturer and saying, no, you got it wrong, we got it right. Anyways, it's bizarre.
Yeah. So I don't think there's anything else we need to talk about ivermectin. Go check out the tools of practice that we have on there. It's got all the numbers, all the references and all of that. And so I think we'll just leave it at that. So thanks as always for listening.
Talk to you later.
So long for now.
See you later.